Hey, hello, I'm David McCoskey, and this is part of our Project Spotlight on Members. And with me today is Rebecca Kiki Morris. It's really part two of our interview. I'm really happy she's here. She's a chaplain at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Portland, Oregon. And we'd like to carry on our conversation from the first go around. So Kiki, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was kind of paint a picture for us about what it means to be a chaplain in the Veterans Administration. That really sounds really kind of, you know, especially coming from a Buddhist background, how you found yourself there, that was in part one. But go ahead and tell us kind of like what a typical week might look like, or, you know, kind of what it is, what it means to be a chaplain up there. What does it look like?
Well, thanks first for it's been fun to continue the conversation and continue contemplating it, David. We've talked about this idea of, I was saying to you a little bit ago about marketing. You know, my job as a chaplain, my personal job has been in marketing. And I'll say a little bit more about that, of marketing, what does it mean to be a certain kind of chaplain? But in contemplating that question, to think of how to say it in a civilian context, is that there is no such thing as a typical day or really even a typical week per se. And there's more of a typical marketing package, what I would say, for chaplaincy. And as an outpatient mental health chaplain, which is very different than, say, an inpatient chaplain, my job is to imagine, create, promote, and implement programming in a way that inpatient chaplaincy does differently. So what I would want to say is there's phases. And when we think of the first phase of chaplaincy, it really is about stabilization. So in any given day or in any given week, there might be a veteran that is referred that really needs stabilization. When we think about inpatient chaplaincy in particular, if you think of someone who's going in for surgery, and then we think of chaplain, most people think, well, the chaplain can basically marry, baptize, and death chaplaincy. I mean, that's really what a lot of times people have thought of when we think of inpatient chaplaincy, which I would say is about, up until the last decade, has really been about 90% of chaplaincy. In the VA, we think of palliative care, end of life care, and then maybe someone wants a prayer before a surgery. Mm-hmm. And so in the last, so that's phase one chaplaincy, really is really allowing for stabilizing somebody when they're in a destabilized, it's in the ER department that maybe our inpatient chaplains, they'll go down to the ER. Someone maybe has been admitted for suicidality and they're going to end up being assessed to be in maybe a locked inpatient unit. So at that phase one of stabilization, and this is based on Judith Herman's three phases of trauma processing, a lot of inpatient chaplaincy has really been on that stabilization piece.
Mm-hmm. And inpatient means these are people that are really patients in a hospital there for a surgical procedure or something like that.
Yeah.
And they're asking for some help from you. And then that's part of that's you as a chaplain coming down and helping them stabilize this kind of uncertainty they have about whatever their situation is being in the hospital.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And help them be in the hospital. And then how some people at that, you think about someone might come in and get a cancer diagnosis. So when you think about inpatient chaplaincy for the VA, it's very, very similar to maybe more typical hospital chaplaincy, which is really focusing on that stabilization piece. Someone might have a cancer diagnosis. People have to have surgeries or they might be getting chemo, or they have to have an ingrown toenail removed, or hernia, or, you know, they end up sick because they were in a car accident. And then when we start to shift into the second phase of chaplaincy, that's where my job as an outpatient mental health chaplain really becomes, a little bit more intricate. So when we look at phase two, this is where a veteran is actually doing more outpatient mental health, intentional work with their mental health processes. And phase two would be maybe looking at they've become stabilized and they're ready to actually do some trauma processing or some sort of processing, whether in the mental health world, they might work with cognitive processing therapy or prolonged exposure. So they're really taking a look at PTSD. They're taking a look at moral injury. And at that point in time, the chaplain's job might be stabilization, or it might be to help that destabilizing process that can happen with trauma processing. So phase two is trauma processing. And that work is really helping to assess and help make meaning out of things that are almost not digestible. Mm-hmm. When we think about taking life, we're talking about men and women who maybe even get sucked into really loving taking life for a while, or mm-hmm. feeling that very vindictive, or a lot of, my friend David got killed, and so I really feel like I'm going to avenge his life. And so I feel good about that process, maybe. Or sometimes people even get sucked into different types of less than inspiring mentalities, which is more of the warrior archetypes of maybe they've raped villages, women, or had to take lives of women and children. So it gets more messy.
Mm-hmm. Does that fall more into the area of moral injury? Say some more about what moral injury is.
Yeah, I think there's a number of aspects of moral injury, but moral injury really is if I have a set of morals, or a set of values, especially if I've been taught in this civilian world, this is how I live my life. Do not kill, be kind to my neighbors. Similar, of our ways of life that we teach in the civilian life. And then when you go into the military, the code can be direct, like diametrically opposed to that, which is now we're going to train you to take life. Now we're going to train you to actually hate the enemy. We're going to train you to do things that weren't trained in the civilian world. So moral injury, this is this fabric that gets woven into a way of being and thinking. And moral injury then happens when I come back, usually into my civilian life. It's not obvious, this tension, mm-hmm. because it's been trained. And then I come back into civilian life and I have this fabric that these old morals are pulling on this way of being. And mm-hmm. so that tension can really create an irreconcilable and an unbearable tension inside of somebody. Maybe I have taken life. Maybe I saw life taken, or I saw something happen and I knew that I could do something about it. But if I did, there would be great ramification on me as a military person. I would be seen as a traitor if I had stopped immoral killing or immoral things happening. There's a lot of hazing that can go on that is very, very real. So, and then some people end up going into the military, they get pegged. And so they went thinking they were going to be protecting people in the United States, maybe, and they end up being hazed, or they get pegged as somebody for many reasons. Mm-hmm. A good one is homosexuality, right? Like you get pegged, and then all of a sudden your life, your own people become dangerous. So you now not only have to, during the day, you might have to serve on a mission, but at night now it's not safe to sleep in your own barracks either. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that can cause moral injury. One is perpetration, something I maybe have done or something I failed to stop from happening. So that's one aspect. The other aspect of moral injury is I trust you, David, to have my back, and you don't. And mm-hmm. so you're violating that, maybe some people end up getting left, or some people, part of their company gets left. Or mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that happen where there's this idea of, well, it's family and no man or woman left behind. And then there's what really happens. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we come home, and initially when people come home, might not be quite as obvious, but maybe a year, a couple years, someone has their own kiddo, they start to realize, holy cow, I took lives of children. They have a wife that they love. They remember looking in the face of a wife as they took her husband. I mean, there's a lot mm-hmm. of things that start to tug on that. So moral injury is when I violate my maybe more internal moral mm-hmm. code from mm-hmm. my civilian world as a military individual, or that code gets violated against me.
And so it kind of manifests as people maybe being depressed or being
suicidal,
angry. Those kinds of things. Uh-huh. So looking for help. Mm-hmm. And so would you see people individually, or would you see people in a kind of a group setting?
Both? Yeah, mm-hmm. both. And that's part of that phase three, you know, mm-hmm. or phase two, sorry, is really working on helping people to untie those knots. Mm-hmm. And then I would say phase three is another part that we get to do, which is really a lot of reintegration work. So I just, as I share that kind of, like I said, marketing package is part of my job. So two-thirds of my job is really doing work with veterans. Mm-hmm. Another third of my job then is applying those same strategies to a lot of staff care, because there's mm-hmm. secondary trauma. Burnout is the number one healthcare crisis. So one-third of my job is to write, create, implement programming both for staff and for veterans. So part of my day can be care of either veterans or staff. A large part of some days can just be tons of meetings, tons of brainstorming, yeah. tons of strategizing, tons of assessments. So there's a lot of, in especially in outpatient mental health, a lot of my world might be not engagement with patients or with care, but it might be a lot about strategy and marketing and implementing and planning and working with other teams. So
that sounds, yeah. I was going to say, it's, you know, the VA is like this big bureaucratic organization, but what you're talking about there sounds more positive than just dealing with a lot of paperwork. You're actually trying to create something, mm-hmm. presumably collaborating with some other people
yeah.
in terms of programs and things you might offer, or talk about problems that need to be solved or something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the assessment and that aspect of not working directly with staff or working directly with veterans and patients. Yeah,
but I would imagine too that administration. Like I do a lot of work with administration mm-hmm. to talk about. I think why I want to say that is we're on the cutting edge of mental health chaplaincy integration that did not exist 20 years ago. But about 15 years ago, there was a national. What is it? A mandate that they, meaning the VA, the Department of Defense, and the National Chaplain Center, they saw that mental health really did an incredible job in where they could do an incredible job. And they saw where chaplaincy really could address what chaplaincy it could address. But there was just right at the very beginning showing that there was this chaplaincy mental health integration that if those two together, the force multiplier of that, the sum was much greater than the parts. So mm-hmm. there became about 15 years ago and this mandate to start this process of really creating mental health chaplaincy integration. And so that really started to take hold as possibility. I mean, you can name something and then a lot of people fight and buck the system. So a decade later, I feel like we're really in a unique time because that mental health chaplaincy integration is where we get to really play, we meaning chaplains, get to really play an integral part of mental health programming in a way that didn't even exist a decade ago.
Yeah, so I'm trying to picture that. And I think I've seen you in Denver. So really what you're talking about there is you're actually collaborating with mental health professionals, clinical psychologists, people like that, right?
Yeah.
But you're bringing kind of a unique perspective coming from the chaplain world into this collaboration with mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So again, I'm trying to paint this picture right now of kind of how this life works for you too. So you'll have support groups that you'll create, and then you'll be collaborating with a mental health professional sometimes, or more often than not, a mental health professional, and you will put these programs together that would be a support group. They'd be meeting once a week or something.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. There's support groups at each level. So we have phase one, we have stabilization support groups at council. We have phase two chaplaincy groups, and we have phase three reintegration chaplaincy groups. So phase one, and I sit on, you know, probably 8 or 10 teams, and they are teams that might have a psychiatrist, a social worker, a new nurse practitioner. They might have a suicide prevention coordinator. They might have a homeless, or HUDVASH, like a homeless. So, and then the chaplain. So you end up with this group of people, and then a referral comes in, and the team assesses this person from all aspects, and then we might create a care plan as a team. Oh, this person's not spiritual. They're not religious, but they're an atheist, but they've lost meaning and purpose, and they're suicidal. Oh, great. Why don't you recommend them to come to our phase one chaplaincy group? Because it's not about religion. Mm-hmm. What it's about is helping to show how community and talking about the impact of trauma on our spirituality, how that lives out in life. And we might have that kind of overt conversation. Mm-hmm. So in a phase two group, we might talk more specifically about it. So
in a given week, do you have like two or three groups going at a time that you're interacting with?
Mm-hmm. And so this coming week, I will have a phase one co-ed and a phase one women's only. I'll have a phase two group, and then I'll also have a phase three group. Then in between, I might have between 10 and 20 individual clients who they need something particular, you know? So they're going to need a little bit, something that, you know, I'll notice something in group that can become a barrier because they need to talk about something more particular than something more generally speaking. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I also see individual veterans throughout the week.
How do you do that now? I mean, before you'd probably do it in person. And now with COVID, do you have to kind of keep your distance? Do you still see people in person, or are you doing things more with Zoom kinds
Everything
of things?
Everything is 100% online. So this is what my work looks like.
It must be a little challenging too then. Huh?
It is challenging. Mm-hmm. There's some benefits. I think as an empath, it takes a little bit of the exchange that happens when you're in person, but it definitely takes a little bit out of just being online all day. There is something else really unique, though, is I watch veterans who can be at their home that don't have to drive and deal with the traffic, and they feel comfortable in their own home. And so often I can see a level of vulnerability that can happen much more quickly online that I would never have imagined.
It's really very interesting.
Yeah. And then they don't have to get back in their car and go back in traffic. They're right at their own home. They can go outside and have a cigarette or do whatever it is they do to integrate, go for a walk, have a cup of coffee. And there's not so much of that distraction. And for, especially when we have veterans with PTSD or trauma, taking away some of those transition times, I've watched be super beneficial. Like I said, in a way we wouldn't have imagined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a pretty full life. You've got these groups, support groups going on. You've got individual meetings you have, and then you're kind of constantly creating something, collaborating with people to create new support groups or have new ideas, and then spending some time at the hospital, being a chaplain there too. Yeah, with actual patients in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, tell us, so one of the things I'm really interested in is that one of the support groups you had, you told us that you were using the Heart Attack Sutra book, which is a book by Carl Brunhosel, really a wonderful book about the Heart Sutra, about 150 pages, but just wonderful commentary by Carl about what this fairly short but very profound Mahayana Sutra is. that's challenging, I think, for all of us who are Buddhists when we encounter it and spend time with it and try to practice it and try to understand it. And here you are using it in some fashion as a means to talk to veterans about things like moral injury. So say some more about that, how you came to that and how you use it.
Well, you and I studied it together, and I got to see even our group. When I think of, in the very beginning, it talks about quantum physics, right? This idea of Prajnaparamita is really, it's there's this parallel to this idea of quantum physics. So there's in the programming that I've got, it can be almost a 2-year process. If someone comes in, let's say suicidal in the ER, they might spend 6 months in just our stabilization group or council. We call it council because we have it's a setup very council style. And then they might do another 6 months working on their moral injury and do the moral injury work. And then we have another 6-month program, which is doing reintegration. Mm-hmm. And then once someone's gone through that kind of year and a half or 2-year process, we also created what's called a peer support training academy. So a lot of veterans, they want to eventually, when mm-hmm. they are able to integrate that trauma, they really want to give back. And I could see that gap. So I created this peer support training academy. So not all of our programs also have state certified peer support specialists, because people have gone through the programming and then they get certified and then they come back through their program as a peer. Well, this year we had a very unique circumstance because of the pandemic. And so the 6-month program got extended a little bit, partly to just help that group of people get stabilized. They were strong anyway. And at the very end of that program, usually then I give people an opportunity to say whether they want to go on and do state certification, go through the peer support specialist training that's actually out in the community, and then they come back. Well, because the community certification was shut down, they didn't have an opportunity. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just work with the group of people that think they want to get state certified, which is something I'd never done before. So I gave them the opportunity to do like just this smaller group after the larger group completed. And that group of 6 people, so you imagine they've been working there. It's a group of people that have been working with me, all of them, for a couple of years. They know me, they want to continue training. They love compassionate warrior training, which is our phase 3. And all of the programs have mindfulness aspects. I'm always weaving mindfulness. Every class that I teach has whether it's just basic shamatha or whether we do a little bit more of analytical meditation. I mean, all the way through. And so here was this group of 6 people, very, very intelligent. A number of them are special ops in this particular cohort. So they were in special operations, very smart, way smarter than me group of folks. And one guy who was a 40 years in service. So you can imagine like a number of quite high ranking folks that they want to come back and be peer support specialists. And I thought, well, I'm going to use the Heart Attack Sutra. I'm going to invite them to go into an experiment. And I said that to them, that this would be an experiment of quantum physics. And so I read that portion to this group of people and said, you know, there's this concept of emptiness that's radically different than the experience of emptiness. And what I'd love to do is have you all imagine. So I gave them the intro chapter and said, would you like to read this book together as part of the experiment of how do we create a peer support specialist team based on reading a book together, so that A, I can assess and see where your strengths are, where I can see where you all normally would slot as a team. You know, so they all read it and they said, we got to do applications. And so they all said, oh my God, that book is so awesome. That sounds amazing. So just by reading the intro, they all opted in. Wow. So I started and I read the actual sutra to them the first day. And then, you know, so I read the sutra and their homework was, you know, to like read the introduction for 2 weeks. We would have our first meeting. We would discuss it. And so, you know, I read the sutra. None of them had read the sutra because it's in the back of the book. So that first day when I read the sutra, or maybe I assigned them to read it, And, you know, my first question to them was, so what do you think? And, that was rock. You can just picture, you know, lots of balking. And I said, excellent. You know, and they all were coming at it from different perspectives. And I could see their mind. What was really incredible is you have someone read this, and just by virtue of their complaints, you can see, or not complaints. Like, there was one woman who just was like, I just love it. So in and of itself, I got to see that the suture in and of itself, especially for a group of people who are intelligent, and you give them the idea of like, they're going to try and figure something out. Like, what does it mean? It became an assessment tool just in a moment, which was, was brilliant to see the mirror that the sutra showed each of their mind. Like, I could see each of their mind in that moment just reflected back from the sutra. And then as we worked through it, and, you know, it was probably a 2-month process to then read the sutra at the end and watch, just in 2 months, no one studied Dharma. We just read this book. We got to see how their flexibility of mind could give up not knowing how to say the word Prajnaparamita. Their mind, just studying it, gave mind a flexibility. It was really quite profound when I think of the impact of simply reading and studying it, generally speaking, with no other Dharma text, as a pith instruction for a bunch of people who have, you know, a couple of years of meditation practice, but informal, you know. And what it did is it created an opportunity that 2 months later, we have this incredibly tight team to watch them contemplating the chapters together. Wow. So, I mean, I was surprised. It was meant to be a, you know, a little bit of a, what would I say? What did I say? It was an experiment. And it turned out to actually be, for an intelligent group of people, quite an incredible opportunity to create a team. And to let them work together on it. And that they really ended up at the end not coming. I didn't ever answer any real questions. And I said, at some point, I was like, well, we could probably ask David, I told them about our group, or Carl. Mm-hmm. And they were all freaked out about the idea of having Carl come, you know, like too intimidating. But I was thinking, how fun would it be for Carl to come and answer some of these questions? Yeah, but we didn't even get that far. It was just a nice way to introduce Dharma. All six of them now want to go forward and study Dharma more deeply. And I think that's also kind of an incredible outcome, is that by reading this pith instruction, all of them want to study Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhism, particularly more in depth.
It's an amazing story, Al, because that's not the typical place one would start in terms of studying Dharma, the Heart Sutra. Yeah. And I really like what you said about flexibility, because I think that is one outcome from practicing and studying the Prajnaparamita, you know, is you're letting go of certain things, which means you have to have a little bit more flexibility, how you see the world, how you experience the world in that way. And of course, you're dealing with these kind of absurdities that there's no this, no that. And you kind of have to let go of those kinds of things too and kind of work your way to understanding it. So that's really wonderful and really great outcome, it sounds like, too.
Especially when you think of moral injury. You know, like, it's like saying, you have a broken heart, but there really is no broken heart. You have a shattered vision of the world, but there really isn't, you know. And so I would say it wasn't the 2 months of reading the book that did that. What we could see also is that our programming that has Buddhism infused all the way through these 2 years, that the programming in and of itself prepped them for flexible mind. It prepped them to be able to read this and to receive it as a beautiful gift to their mind.
Mm-hmm. Very cool, yeah. Do you think you might try it again for another group? I mean, there's so many teachings out there, you know, that you could kind of call upon, you know, in the right kind of way at the right kind of time.
Mm-hmm. I think what it did is it opened a gate also for me, David. Mm-hmm. So one of your questions was about, you know, whether I'm an interfaith chaplain or a Buddhist specific chaplain. And up to this point, I've been a little more shy, mainly because a chaplain here has three main things. My job is to make sure that someone has spiritual care in their language, to not proselytize to them, and to be a gatekeeper from anyone else proselytizing to them. Mm-hmm. And you know, to make an assessment, and like if they need a Catholic priest to give them sacrament, well, that sure is not going to be something I'm going to do. So my job is to make that referral. But the non-proselytizing piece is a real big deal for me, so that, you know, everything I do is really in a common language, not mm-hmm. in Buddhist language. And because mindfulness is such a accessible thing these days, it allows for me mm-hmm. to bring mindfulness into any group and not have it be proselytization. It's a big part of our whole health programming, mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. So it's a nice time to be a Buddhist chaplain and have the backdrop of I'm not proselytizing, but I've not done any Buddhist specific teachings. You know, this mm-hmm. was kind of the first yeah. dabble in. Mm-hmm. I would say going forward from here, what this also helped me to see and maybe build my confidence of what the subtle lines of proselytization and not proselytization, invitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, invitation.
I mm-hmm. think as a result now of speaking more openly, we have a waiting list, and it's not a waiting list, it's a roster of about 10 people who want a specifically Buddhist meditation programming. And we've been talking about how to now collaborate with Nalanda Bodhi and maybe use some of our curriculum mm-hmm. to bring into the VA for mm-hmm. people who are interested in studying Buddhism proper, not mm-hmm. like Thich Nhat Hanh, where it's just general Dharma teachings, but very specific. Mm-hmm. A lot of people use Thich Nhat Hanh or Pema Chodron's books, you know, mm-hmm. in life. Mm-hmm. So I feel like this is, for me, given me more confidence as well that I can make those offerings in the VA without violating my mm-hmm. my agreements of what it means to be a chaplain, and then also starting to implement more Buddhist specific teachings mm-hmm. Going forward.
Yeah, it was interesting when I talked to Brett Campbell, who is a chaplain with the Air Force with active duty members, and he was kind of talking about how most of his time is spent being kind of a interfaith or non-denominational chaplain, mm-hmm. but he does have Air Force people, men and women, who are interested in Buddhism, mm-hmm. and so he's created support groups or groups of people who actually are interested in learning more about Buddhism. So he's actually has used the 37 practices of a Bodhisattva as a way to talk about some of the teachings and to talk about some of the things, maybe you're doing around that moral injury side of things too. So yeah, it's really quite amazing in that way. So
the other thing that's cool, David, is clinicians. There are so many clinicians. I mean, because I'm on these teams, a lot of clinicians now have asked, like, do you teach more Buddhist meditation for staff? So that's the other piece, is we mm-hmm. have staff and clinical people who necessarily maybe don't want to go find a sangha per se, but they're interested in studying Buddhism with clinicians.
Sorry for that. A little domestic thing. The cat ran out the door. Yeah.
So I think that's the other thing, is it's, you know, and I'm sure Brett finds this as well. Our job is both veteran facing and staff facing. And I'm finding more and more staff that are interested in non-Christian mm-hmm. things.
Wanting to learn more about what does Buddhism have to offer?
Yep. Yeah.
And how do I apply that in my life, kinds mm-hmm. of things.
Uh-huh. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the things that, so when you talk about mindfulness, you really, but you are kind of teaching a kind of a mindfulness meditation practices.
Every class.
Yeah.
Every class. But
they're not Buddhist based at all. They're just kind of generic mindfulness meditation on how to.
They might be what Rinpoche might call like Buddhist light. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're Buddhist in that the language just gets softened. So it's mm-hmm. it's foundational shamatha, a lot of analytical meditation.
Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of beginning to look at your mind, to kind of understand your mind, a more experiencing mind. Yeah. Yep. Through meditation practices by calming things down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's pretty exciting to see if we, or this other project might go with using the Lanta Bodhi curriculum, the meditation curriculum, for some of the groups that you'd be working with that would be interested in a more Buddhist approach to meditation. Yeah. We'll see. Yeah. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Kiki, about, you know, this wonderful thing you're doing up there, creating these programs, seeing these programs through, the collaboration aspect of things. And I'm sure it's a little bit hard with COVID-19 in terms of the challenges it presents, but, as you said, there's some opportunity, different kinds of opportunities in trying to work with things online too. Yeah.
It's an interesting time to be a chaplain. When I often make this joke, like, it is real job security right now in a way that we were always appreciated before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm finding people are really leaning on, at least in Portland, they're really leaning on our service to keep a real sense of human and compassion. Yeah. And so I think that's what's really incredible in this time is seeing how initially when they called in the psychologists, they then flipped and they asked the chaplains to come and just do like some grieving debrief. So we've become just even more than ever a part of the stabilization team for the whole system.
Is it kind of fair, do you think it's fair to say they're kind of leaning into a more spiritual approach to trying to deal with some of their anxiety, some of their issues, depression and so on? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Looking for more meaning in some ways. Yeah. Oh, very cool. Well, thank you. So one of the things I'd like to do as a follow-up, I've talked to Brett about this too, so I think we'll have to see how we put this together, but it'd be fun to have you and Brett together as our two chaplains, our two Buddhist chaplains who are working, in your case, with veterans, and Brett's case, with active Air Force people, about how things are working, and maybe bring somebody else into that too. So like have kind of a panel discussion, and we'd probably make that a live discussion rather than one of our recordings too. But this is a great start to hear more about how, you know, what you're doing, and to spend some time learning more about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, mm-hmm. David. It's always great to, it's great and fun to share. So I'll see you soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Kiki. Thank you very much.